Hello and welcome to Fourth Estate, a show about journalism. We're coming to you from 2SER in Sydney on the Gadigal lands of the Eora Nation, right across Australia on the Community Radio Network and directly to your device across the globe via podcast. I'm Monica Attard. Well, the first anniversary of the war between Russia and Ukraine has come and gone. With it, there were tens of thousands of words written about how the Ukrainians have survived the Russian invasion. And with more money and tanks on their way from the United States, the European Union and the Scandinavian countries, how Ukraine cannot now lose the war. Wars, of course, are times when propaganda is in its element. On the Russian side, there's been more than enough propagandizing about the capacity to win the battle. But are either side right? Can this war end in a victory for either side? And how has the news media dealt with the nuance? Joining us today to talk about this is freelance journalist and former BBC reporter Leonid Rogozin, who keeps a very close watch on the information channels which have been used by propagandists on both sides. Rogozin is Russian, but since the Russian annexation of Crimea in 2014, he's lived outside his country in Latvia. So Leonid, thank you very, very much for joining us here on Fourth Estate. The last time that you were on this program, the war was just 2 weeks old, and at the time you viewed it as an irrational move by Putin, a man that you viewed as a gangster and in charge of a gangster state. Since then, of course, Ukraine has reversed Russia's main advance, resulting in Putin calling a partial mobilization, calling up hundreds of thousands of troops to stabilize the war. How do you now view this war some 50 weeks down the track?
Well, right. It's been a year since Putin started his aggression against Ukraine, the full-out aggression, as opposed to the first stage of the war in which Russia occupied Crimea and started a smaller-scale conflict in the east of Ukraine. We saw largest military conflict in the European history. Since probably the World War II. I'm not sure how it compares to the Yugoslav wars, but at least in geographical terms, it's a war on a larger scale.
It seems more consequential.
It does, yeah, definitely, absolutely. After a year of war, it only feels that the two sides have more appetite for more war, and the escalation has been going on throughout the war, throughout the hostilities in the in 2022, with the Russians first advancing on the south of Ukraine, on Kiev, and then the Ukrainians managing to launch a counteroffensive and regain more territory, but the Russians started the operation as almost a an anti-riot, a police operation, when they launched the attack on Kiev and sent their troops, they didn't form a front line. They just sent one column that eventually got stuck on the road, and the column was 100 kilometers long. They didn't really expect it to turn into a proper war with the front lines, but obviously the Ukrainians have managed to mount resistance, and eventually what we are seeing now is something more akin to world wars in Europe, with a front line that stretches for hundreds and hundreds of kilometers from the Sea of Azov, from the Black Sea, actually, in Kherson region, to Kharkov region in the north. It's still possible that the Russians might launch new offensives out of Belarus or out of Kursk and Bryansk regions which border the northern Ukraine. Yes, a huge war, and the year ahead, we're seeing the Western allies of Ukraine supplying more armed vehicles and more sophisticated weapons to Ukraine. There is now talk about supplying Ukraine with sophisticated modern fighter jets.
Do you think that will happen, leader? Because it's highly contested, and the United States is very much holding out on that front, holding out on promising those fighter jets. Do you believe that will happen?
Well, I think the latest statement by Jake Sullivan was to the effect that it's just not the right time to talk about it. But the hint. Was that the time will eventually come for the United States to unfreeze this particular item and allow the Ukrainians to receive fighter jets, but that may come at a different stage in the battle.
Yeah, so it certainly looks at this point as though it's going to be a long war of attrition on the battlefield. But still, you know, you've got many, many people within the Western commentariat and indeed in the US government who predict a decisive victory for Ukraine. Now, I mean, obviously propaganda plays its part, but how on the mark do you think that assessment is, that Ukraine has an ability and a capacity to actually outright win this war on the battlefield?
Yes, the discourse of Ukraine's victory, and by victory we mean Ukraine liberating all the lands currently occupied by Russia in the east and south of the country, including Crimea, the peninsula which Russia occupied back in 2014. So I think for Ukraine, for the Ukrainian leadership, it is important to talk about full liberation, because that's their way to mobilize support in the West, and that's their way of projecting confidence. For the so-called friends of Ukraine in the West, and particularly in Eastern Europe, it is the same. It is about selling this idea to the broad public that Ukraine can actually win, and therefore it does make sense to supply it with all the possible weapons, including the tanks, the sophisticated modern tanks that are now being supplied, and the anti-aircraft facilities that are also being supplied. Then the next stage that is being discussed now is the fighter jets. That is attainable, that's another question. And what we see on the front line now is that the Russian forces are making slow advances. They are very close to capturing Bakhmut in a major battle of this winter. There is talk about the Ukrainians preparing a counteroffensive sometime this spring. Whether it will materialize, whether they will be able to break through the Russian defenses, which are now proper defenses, Russia is prepared to this counteroffensive. That's extremely unclear. And of course, people are also talking about the Russian offensive, which has either started already, as the Ukrainians claim, or it is yet to begin, because we know very little really about the reserves that Russia has accumulated since it started mobilization in the fall last year, and How many of these 300,000 people are already on the front line, and how many of them are still in the reserves waiting for their time, waiting for a major offensive? That we don't know. What we can say very confidently is that we will see a carnage on a much greater scale this year than we saw last year, at least from judging by this talk about offensives and counteroffensives.
Lena, one of the things I think that's been less reported, particularly in the last few weeks, is a move from President Macron of France, and aligning with Germany at least on this issue, expressing some doubt about Ukraine's ability to win the war. In fact, Macron has told President Zelensky, according to some reports, to settle the war, begin negotiations, and in exchange, what Ukraine will receive is a push through on some security arrangement with NATO, which might fall short of full membership, but at least guarantee Ukraine some short-term safety. I wanted to ask you firstly, why you think that's received so little attention in Western media circles? And secondly, what chance you think there is that Ukraine will heed Macron's advice?
The way the discourse regarding the war in Ukraine is being shaped in the West, that requires a very thorough analysis, which I guess some people are doing already, but in future, historians particularly of mass media will have laws and laws of work to do in that respect. But what we have is specific lobbyist groups that promote the idea of Ukraine completely defeating Russia and liberating all of its territory. Well, these lobbyist groups, they control the information space. And the situation is quite unique in the sense that, as you rightly said, such important voices as Macron's or voices coming from Germany are essentially not being heard in the English language discourse, which is not reduced to English speaking countries. It is the main platform, the main language in which the whole world is discussing the war in Ukraine. Mm-hmm. Largely because most people are now getting the information from social networks, from platforms like Twitter and Facebook. And on these platforms, particularly on Twitter, it is the lobbyist groups which maintain troll farms and bot farms. These groups are essentially controlling the discourse. And so that's why we really hear a lot of talk, which may or may not be substantiated, about Ukraine winning the war. And when we hear the voices like Macron's or some of the even American pundits, pundits from Rand Corporation, for example, who doubt the ability of Ukraine to win this war completely and who say that it will end with negotiations. But these voices are being suppressed, and they're being suppressed by those bot farms and troll farms that are being maintained by partisan groups interested in a military solution in Ukraine.
And has the policy decisions by some of the platforms, the digital platforms, and indeed by some Western governments to suppress Russian argument, Russian voices on this issue, is that also playing a role?
That's how they frame it. They say that they are fighting Russian propaganda, but their definition of Russian propaganda is now extremely broad. And who they are suppressing in effect at the moment it's not really Russian propaganda. They are suppressing moderate voices in the West primarily, who are expressing doubt about, and that's reasonable doubt about the Ukraine's ability to win this war, to end this war without ceding parts of its territory to Russia, but also about the human cost of this war, the human cost of endlessly pursuing full victory to Ukraine.
What's the cost of that? I mean, what is the net result of that stand?
Neither side is giving us true figures of the casualties. There are various assessments, according to the most reliable of them, we can say that more than 100,000 of troops on the Russian side and also more than 100,000 troops on the Ukrainian side perished in this war. The caveat is that there is a more sort of conservative assessment done by the BBC BBC Russian service, Mediazona, a Russian media outlet. They count Russian losses from open sources. Mm-hmm. So this count is incomplete, definitely, but the figures they give are way smaller. They're talking about first dozens of thousands of Russian troops that definitely perished, and their deaths were reported in this or other way on in the media or in social networks. We're talking about dozens of thousands or maybe more than 100,000 people on either side in this war. And then the losses among the civilians are much smaller, which is the unusual feature of this war. Mm-hmm. But we're still talking about more than 10,000 civilians who perished in the war zone in Ukraine. So that's the human cost so far.
It's enormous, and it's almost unfathomable. But as you speak, I'm wondering whether, you know, there is a chance that the fact that this war is being fought in the social media age, with a raging information war, which I believe you have documented, given the kind of dynamics of it, whether this is a turning out to be a much more vicious war than anything we might have seen had it not occurred in this particular era of digital transformation.
Yes, I think that's very true. There is one aspect created by social media is the gamification of the war. You can see on Twitter how many accounts there are. Anonymous accounts and accounts run by real humans. How many of them treat the war as an adventure, essentially, and something that is fun reporting, that is fun participating in. So there is a lot of bravado and toxic masculinity in there, and yes, for large amounts of people, it creates the impression that that this war is essentially okay. I find it amazing how seamlessly has our modern 21st century society transited into this situation of something that becomes, that is looking more and more like a world war, not even a regional war. Mm. And people continue to live their usual lives in most countries. And many people treat this war as, you know, as a football match. They just they support one side, and they are very passionate about rooting for this side. But the human cost of this war just doesn't occur to many people. This is an abstraction for them. All those soldiers and civilians who are dying in this war.
I suppose that accounts also for what we're seeing now, which I find personally very surprising, which is a pro-war left, very, very evident on social media. That is a group of people who are opposed to Ukraine negotiating with Russia on anything at all, even if the cost of that is significantly higher Ukrainian deaths than there needs to be. Has that surprised you at all?
No, it is. It is surprising to me, of course, because my school years following the Cold War in the Soviet Union, and all my upbringing was about basically the lethal threat of nuclear war. And the fear of nuclear war was very genuine on both sides of the divide during the Cold War. People were afraid in the West. People were definitely afraid in the Soviet Union. The education and upbringing in the Soviet Union was all about fighting for peace and fighting against the war and preventing the war from happening. I suppose it looked very differently in the Western propaganda, but that's how things were perceived by us in the Soviet school. So for people of my generation, both in Russia and in Ukraine, what is happening between these two countries is essentially unthinkable. And then now we get all those people who, easily brush away they talk about nuclear war, which I think is very possible in the current situation, and especially if Putin starts losing in Ukraine, or if Russia eventually loses Crimea, if he feels cornered. But surprisingly for me, for many people, and particularly for people in the United States, it all seems very abstract. They don't believe that nuclear war is possible, because why would Putin strike? He's not suicidal. And for them, it's like, obviously he's not suicidal. For me, it's not obvious at all. He's an old man who has had everything he could in his life. He's spoken many times about Muammar Gaddafi's terrible death in Libya. He definitely doesn't wish this kind of death to himself. So I can expect anything from this kind of person. He started this war, which felt unthinkable. So why wouldn't he start something that is even more unthinkable? But there are people who say that he won't do it, and just because he won't do it. And then there are people who say, well, if he does it, then it's okay, because he will use the tactical nuclear weapons first against Ukraine. And that's okay, because this is going to be in Ukraine, and Ukrainians will only get stronger, and they will repel the Russian aggression with more fury if that happens. So I find this all this talk, it's outrageous, and I find it completely unacceptable. It just this is something that is dangerous and should be stopped right away. Nuclear war is a real threat, and it can end up in the elimination of the entire humanity.
Leonard, one of the pieces of information that Western media has come to accept and repeat ad nauseum is that the world is against Russia and in support of Ukraine. But it actually turns out that that's not entirely correct. I mean, there are large swathes of Asia, not to mention China. There's the African nations and the South American nations that don't support Ukraine and they don't support the US actions in Ukraine. We're hearing a lot about this now. What's the impact of this, if any? And why are we only hearing about it now, do you think?
I think we're hearing about it now because it sort of occurred to Western pundits and to politicians and to the American administration, first of all, that yes, the bigger world, the outer world, the world beyond rich Western countries, is essentially neutral about this war. It doesn't support either side or it's showing some kind of token support to Ukraine, but essentially it continuing to have business as usual with Russia. And then there are more worrying signs for the American administration, such as joint military drills between Russia and South Africa, for example. So yes, there is a cause for worry, and then of course part of the equation in this war is the grain deal, in which Russia is allowing ships carrying grain from Ukraine, a major one of the world's main grain producers, to be taken out of Ukraine, out of the port of Odessa, into the greater world, and first of all to the developing countries. Countries outside the first world, they are primarily thinking about their food security because both in Ukraine and Russia are major suppliers of cereals for these countries. They're looking at energy security as well. The impact of this war on oil exports from Russia, on which they are also dependent. But then also, of course, their attitude to conflict, in which the United States is somehow involved, is quite different to that of the United States itself and of its allies in Western Europe and in Eastern Europe. Their view on the Middle Eastern conflict in particular, on Israel and Palestine, on the war in on wars in the Near East, on Iraq, on Afghanistan, they are quite different. They don't essentially see the United States as this angelic force that is liberating the world from evil and that is saving civilians. So that's another factor that affects the judgment in this war. So they are more sensitive to all the criticism that appears regarding Ukraine, and much of this criticism is substantiated.
Yeah, I think it's interesting, though, that there are certain sections of the media, not mainstream media, but non-mainstream media, particularly digital, in the digital sphere, that have been talking about these issues of who supports, who doesn't, what the cost is for those nations that are expected to show a hand of support but haven't yet for Ukraine. Yet it's only beginning now to break through into mainstream media. And I find that really, really curious, because less than a month ago, I would have said that even mentioning any of this, you would be accused as a reporter of whataboutism, you know, which is a dirty word in journalism. What do you think is making the difference now?
Well, look, I'm not really detecting much of a difference. I'm seeing a more op-eds and analysis in the mainstream American media, which kind of broadens the horizon on this war and on Ukraine. But fundamental historical issues, such as the Bucharest summit on NATO, back 15 years ago, in which it was decided that Ukraine will pursue NATO membership. This is being discussed on Twitter, all these circumstances regarding it, that that it was a compromise, that the Americans were pushing for Ukraine to become a full-blown candidate for NATO, and France and Germany were against it, and then they came to a kind of compromise that didn't really suit anybody. What we can say for sure that that decision did trigger the Kremlin. And I guess in the Kremlin's calculation, one important issue was that NATO membership was an extremely unpopular subject in Ukraine itself at that time. If you look at the polls back in 2006, 2007, then the support of NATO membership in Ukraine would be anything between 10 and 20%. But nevertheless, the government of President Yushchenko, which was losing power at the time, was extremely corrupt and extremely unpopular. It decided to make this PR coup by paving the way for Ukraine to enter NATO. The lobbyist groups that are promoting conflict with Russia, they are promoting the narrative of NATO not being part of the story, that what is really happening is just that Russia has these imperial ambitions that it wants to expand and expand and expand, and if you don't stop them in Ukraine, then they will attack Finland and Baltic countries and Germany, and so we'll go all the way to the British Isles. If you look at the Russian discourse, it's not quite like that. There is an imperialist streak that is only really becoming visible or important now, but back then it was definitely primarily about NATO and about the very genuine fear in Russia that is being manipulated by Putin, that is being manipulated by this government, which takes a lot from far right parties and organizations in the West, and its rhetoric is polarizing, and it's about picturing Russia as a besieged fortress. But in these rhetorics, the most important issue was NATO. Really, it was the West approaching Russian borders and installing bases and aiming to destroy Russia, and this is now turning into a self-fulfilling prophecy, because now we are seeing people like Ben Hodges, the former American commander of all American troops in Europe, saying that yes, Russia will fall apart, and it sounds from there is you know, excitement in his current prophecy. So some people, particularly in Eastern Europe, they do talk about dismantling Russia as the goal of the current world, of the current war, and that, of course, the main beneficiary of all of this is Putin. We're talking about beneficiaries of this conflict, then I would rank them in the way that number one beneficiary is Putin, because he has completely destroyed the opposition, and thanks to this war, the war allowed him to do it. and he has strengthened his grip on power. He prolonged his rule for as long as this conflict continues. And then the other beneficiaries, far-right governments and politicians in Eastern Europe, particularly the Polish government, that's sticking to power only thanks to this conflict. And then, of course, all those lobbyist groups in the West that represent the military-industrial complex.
It's certainly a really frightening moment in time, that's for sure. Leonard, I have one final question for you, if you might answer for me briefly, and that is concerning China, because it has, of course, entered the game with offers to negotiate peace. But the tone of Western reporting, I'm interested to hear your views on. Do you think that that has been a sceptical tone of reporting, or do you think it's been a perfectly reasonable one?
Well, I'm not a China specialist, and I'm in no position to judge as to how bellicose is China itself. I'm very much focused on the Western media and on the Western discourse, and I'm a part of it myself. So what I'm seeing looks to me as an appetite in some circles for a conflict with China, and at the same time there is appetite for this conflict with Russia. One, I think, a litmus test is that there is very little talk about trying to get Russia on the Western side in the conflict, in the brewing conflict with China. Somehow it is okay for the people that are pushing for conflict with both countries. It is okay for them to be pushing Russia away and towards China. Although, of course, the logical outcome of it is that Russia becomes an ally with China and Russia's nuclear arsenal, which can, as you know, destroy humanity and destroy the Western world, it will essentially be part of this alliance that includes China eventually. Again, from the logical point of view, you think that you need to try and get Russia on your side, either through compromise or through the change of government in Russia for a more pro-Western government as a result of a democratic movement. But again, all those lobbyist groups, for some reason, they're involved in bashing Russian opposition, in bashing Navalny, and bashing anything that's related to Russia, including the anti-Putin forces, very much so. Why is that happening? I don't know. There is a lot of irrationality in the discourse. And there is no good analysis of this discourse that is going on in Western media and in the West in general.
Okay, Leonard, we'll leave it there for the moment. Thank you very, very much for your time and for the very, very thoughtful and interesting comments that you've made. And hopefully Fourth Estate will talk to you again very soon.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
And thanks to you for listening to the program. This edition was recorded at the studios of 2SER and heard across the country on the Community Radio Network. Fourth Estate is produced with the assistance of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. Thanks to the Foundation for their continuing support. Make sure you subscribe to Fourth Estate on your favourite podcast app so that you can hear us talk media, politics and everything in between. We'll be back with more next week, but in the meantime, you can stay in touch with us on Twitter. Our handle there is Fourth Estate AU. Thanks to my producer, Anthony Dockwell. I'm Monica Attard, and thank you for listening.